UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
A part of a series that is very slowly going on as the weeks go by. And this is the second of what I hope will be a five-part series, which I've called The Worldview of Self. And a few weeks ago, I attempted a portrait of the modern self at the end of the 20th century. And this is a portrait that very much reflects yourself and myself. And in that lecture, I sounded a somewhat apocalyptic note, as I declared that the modern self is sick unto death, and that's because the modern self has become narcissistic. And the word narcissistic takes us back to the Greek myth of Narcissus, and we learn from that myth that narcissism is the way to death. When you focus on yourself to the exclusion of the other, in the end you kill yourself. And what I find so alarming about the modern self, that includes me, is that we have become so self-conscious that we have lost any meaningful contact with the other. There has now become this serious distortion between the subject and object relationship. We've become so withdrawn into the self, so focused on the self, so self-conscious that we've lost touch or meaningful touch with the other. We are witnessing a self-absorption which is so excessive today that the modern has lost touch with objective reality. And that's a very serious state of affairs. Never forget that this is the root of all psychosis. When we live in a self-created world which is detached from the world, we become psychotic. That's what psychosis is. So if I tell you today I'm Napoleon, and that has no basis at all in reality, there's something sick if I really believe that about myself. So when we enter the world of the self and lose touch with the other, We are really in a place of sickness. And I said for me that this withdrawal into the self, the withdrawal from the world of the real, has actually created a new world view, a new way of looking at the world. I call this the world view of self. And I put forth last time, as I try to get into the psychology of the modern self, that our whole view of reality today has become self-referential. And we've now come to the point where we judge the real by its impact on the self. So only that which impacts us existentially is real. So when we ask what is real, well, it's that which has an impact on me, touches me existentially, it touches my existence in time and space. That then is real. But the self is at the center. And that's how we now view reality. And I said that trapped inside such a worldview, we're slowly choking to death. And it seems at a human level that there's little hope that we can escape such a world. Now what I want to do in this lecture is to focus on the causes of this modern phenomenon. And I do believe it's modern. I believe this is the first time in history that a culture has become narcissistic. And I want to ask today, what has brought on this appalling condition? What are the causes of it? And I think it's important for us to see that this worldview of self did not arise in a vacuum. It's not ex nihilo, something out of nothing. There are causal links which we can trace and must trace in order to understand why we've arrived at this place. And what I want to do in this lecture is to show you that the modern self is actually the product of modernism. It's a direct consequence of a fundamental shift which took place in Western civilization in the 17th and the 18th century. And it's these shifts that took place back then which has given rise to the modern world we're familiar with and created the modern self. So I believe the worldview of self which defines the modern at the end of the 20th century is the final point of the journey in the modernist enterprise. It's the logical extension of what was already implicit in the foundations of modernism. So it's not something brand new in that sense. It was locked in right there at the beginning of modernism. And although it may have taken us hundreds of years to kind of work this out, for it to be all unraveled, it was locked into modernism right there at the beginning. So it's my contention that modernism has actually come of age in the worldview of self. This is the final stage of the journey. So the narcissistic self at the end of the 20th century is the ultimate indictment for me of modernism. When you see what a wretched worldview it is, a wretched place for the modern self to be, and you see that this is the ultimate indictment of modernism, it reveals how bankrupt it really is and how it really does need to be consigned forever to the dustbin. Now, what I want to do in this lecture is to look at the foundations, therefore, of modernism and to trace how it's led through to the worldview of self. And what we're demonstrating here is that ideas have consequences, because I'm focusing in today's lecture in the world of ideas. And we need to see that ideas have consequences. And this is a point which Francis Schaeffer frequently made. He often put it like this: ideas have legs. And this is so true. The fact is, ideas fundamentally shape us as individuals. We are very much what we think. And the presuppositions that we carry around with us in our heads very much determine who we are, determines the type of choices we make, determines the goals we have, determines the way we live in our universe. So ideas fundamentally shape us as individuals, and the same is true at the larger level of what we are as a culture. So to understand how we've become this narcissistic culture, we have to understand the ideas that preceded this moment in history that led to this point where we're locked inside the self. So this is just highlighting how important ideas are. And that is why we take ideas very seriously here at LaBrie. It's not about becoming an intellectual. That's not what LaBrie is about. It's about transformation. We become transformed by the renewing of our minds as we engage with true ideas which are true. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. The world of ideas, the arguments, the thought, taking them captive to make it obedient to the Lord Jesus Christ. And we do that because ideas are important. Ideas have consequences. So what I'm going to do this week is to look at the ideologies in modernism which have given rise to the worldview of self. In my next lecture, I'm not going to promise it's going to be next week. No more broken promises. But in my next lecture, whenever that happens to be, what I want us to do then is to look at the sociological context in modernity which helped to shape this culture of narcissism. So today, ideology, ideas. Next time, sociology, modernity, and the context there that shaped the culture of narcissism. But today we're going to look at modernism in terms of ideas, ideology. Firstly, what I want to do is look at the ideas which undergird modern philosophy, which have led to the worldview of self. Secondly, I want to look at the ideas which undergird modern science, which have led to the worldview of self. Now, this is big stuff here. Modern philosophy, modern science. What in these have led to the worldview of self? These are the two things I want to cover. So let's start there with philosophy. Now, Western philosophy finds its roots in what is known as the pre-Socratic philosophers. Pre means before Socrates. Those philosophers who precede Socrates. Socrates lived or was born in the 5th century before Christ. And before him, there were a number of philosophers who, in a sense, are the founders of the Western philosophical tradition. A man by the name of Thales, who lived in the 7th century BC, is supposedly the father of Western philosophy. He's the first we know of. And we need to understand that Western philosophy is rooted in what's known as the classical tradition. When we use this word classical, we're referring to the culture of Greece and later of Rome and all that came out of this culture. And we need to see that the classical world was rooted in a pagan cosmology. Now, that doesn't mean all of it was bad. Much of the classical world was noble and worthy of praise. In fact, what inspired John Calvin in the Reformation was a lot of classical thought. So it wasn't all bad, although it was rooted in a pagan cosmology. Now, it was the thinking of Plato and Aristotle, who came after Socrates, that brought the classical philosophical tradition to its apex, to its climax. And these two men have exerted an immense influence in philosophy down through the ages. In fact, it's said that all modern philosophy is really a footnote to Plato and Aristotle. That's how significant these guys were. Now, it's important for us to know that from the first century AD onward, so after the time of Christ, Christianity exerted a tremendous influence on the direction of philosophical thought. In the first century, these two streams of classical and Christian came together. And Christianity exerted a huge influence. So figures like Augustine and Thomas Aquinas later on were the intellectual giants of their day, two well-known names. But we need to see that these men were serious Christians. And though the roots of classical philosophy remained, and often in a very negative fashion, the Bible was still foundational to knowledge back then. Foundational. So from the first century onwards, the Bible was central to philosophical inquiry in the Western world. We need to have that in our minds. And so this had a major impact, therefore, in the whole of Western culture, because ideas have consequences. So the Bible's place in the thinking of the medieval person ensured that their presuppositions were in a broad-based way Christian. Many imperfections in it. But the people of the medieval period had a Christian worldview. That's how they viewed the world. Because philosophy, as it trickled down, and philosophy always does. You might know nothing about philosophy, but it has an impact in your life. Because it trickles down. In the medieval period, because the Bible was very foundational to philosophy, the worldview of the person on the streets, if you like, was in a broad-based way Christian. But, and here's my main point, this all changed in the early 17th century. Something took place back then which completely changed the direction of philosophy. And you say, why philosophy? Just get back to the modern self. But to get to the modern self, we have to do this work. What happened back in the early 17th century? Well, a change took place through a man by the name of René Descartes. Descartes. And Descartes is known as the father of modern philosophy. Some people argue that title, but I think, from my perspective, it's very, very true. A major shift took place with Descartes. Now, it's important for us to know that Descartes was a serious Christian. Serious Christian. And he was not out in his philosophical method to purposefully undermine Christianity in the church. That was not for a moment his purpose. In fact, it was quite the opposite. Descartes was actually reacting in his day against the skepticism which had become prevalent amongst the circle of philosophers back at that moment in history. So there was a new skepticism that was very popular. And this new skepticism posited that nothing, absolutely nothing, could be known with certainty. And most devastatingly to the church, that included the existence of God. Now, Descartes was a very bright young man. He had a background in mathematics and philosophy. And one of the cardinals in the Catholic Church noticed him and encouraged Descartes to take up this challenge of skepticism. And he challenged Descartes to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that God did indeed exist. So Descartes, taking up this challenge, had two main goals. First of all, the defeat of skepticism, to show that there are things you can know with certainty. Secondly, the defeat of atheism. Now, they sound like noble goals. This is what Descartes set out to attack. Now, for Descartes, the human reason alone could provide certain knowledge and defeat the enemy of skepticism. You started with human reason to make a frontal attack on the enemies. So starting with the mind, Descartes set about to accomplish his goals. Now, what he did was this. He attempted to achieve his goals by clearing the ground of everything that was not certain. So all that could not be absolutely verified, beyond any shadow of a doubt, had to be rejected. And for Descartes, faith did not fit into that category. Because faith believes in that which cannot be proved. So that too had to go. And Descartes thought that if all the uncertainties were cleared away, then you'd be left with indubitable certainties. Certainties that were absolutely verifiable. Certainties which no one could possibly deny. And then skepticism would be dealt with. Now the question for Descartes was this. Where could he start in order to arrive at such certainties? What could he himself know with absolute certainty? Well, Descartes actually chose as his starting point the same skepticism that marked his contemporaries. He started from the place of absolute doubt. He said, nothing exists. I'll be a total skeptic. I'll be a nihilist. Nothing exists. And then starting from this point, he moved on to the fact that I'm doubting means that I'm thinking. And the fact that I think means that I am. I exist. The self exists. Cognito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. That was the starting point right there. Well, he started with doubt. I doubt means I think. I think means I am. And then from this, he moved on in his logic to say that since we exist, there has to be some cause to us. We can't exist in a vacuum. There must be some cause to us, and therefore that cause has to be God. I won't give you the links in between all of that. And then he went on to say, because there's a God, the world must also exist. So you see how he extended his logic. Now, without getting into all the complexities of Cartesian thought, which I don't really understand myself, I want us to see what happened. What happened? The Cartesian method, by Cartesian I mean that which is rooted in Descartes, the Cartesian method rooted the whole of reality in the self. This is a huge shift, massive shift. It rooted the whole of reality in the self. First of all, certainty is rooted in the self now as the thinking subject. So the fact that the self thinks is the starting place for knowledge, for all knowledge and certainty. Roger Lunden says it was Descartes that prompted Western thinkers to believe that the isolated, unaided self could discover truth through its own rationalization. Now, we're so used to this. This is normal for us, but it was such a radical change back there. And it was also the starting point of the self that led to the conclusion that God and the world existed. The self precedes both God and the world. That's significant too. In fact, this is in direct contrast to the way it actually happened. The starting point for everything is God. God then makes the world. And after he makes the world, he makes the self. Descartes reversed that whole thing. And he put the self first. In terms of his method, his project. Now this Cartesian method, which was born out of a noble goal to defeat skepticism and to defeat atheism, actually gave rise to modernism. Whole way of modern thinking. Because you see, the whole foundation of modernism is anthropocentric. It's a man-centered, self-centered starting point. You start with the self. And with the self in the center, you then have a proper basis for truth and certainty. It all started with Descartes. Now, not only did Descartes begin with the self as the root to certainty, he did something else, which has significantly impacted us today. What Descartes also did was to isolate the self from the real, from objective reality. He's the guy who made this massive separation between subject and object, which does exist in a sense, but he pitted these two and made a dualism out of the two of them. You see, in his attempt to find indubitable certainties, Descartes drew a sharp line between the self and extended reality. So now there's a separation between the cognitive, the thinking I, the self, and the other, the objective reality. You see, his approach isolated the self from the world of the other. Now, for Descartes, it was absolutely necessary to isolate the self from extended reality in order to ensure objectivity and certainty. You had to separate the self. You see, it's only as the subject stands outside of the object that certain knowledge could be attained. That's the way Descartes thought. So the self stands outside of reality and sees it then as it really is. So what Descartes tried to do was establish a spectator's gallery from which the self could make observations about the world. So it's almost as if we transcend and come outside of the rest of reality and look in. And then with the detachment of the self from the other, we can see the world as it really is. Objectivity. Modern science is premised on that principle, that we see the world with perfect objectivity. Now, what we have come to realize in the latter part of this century that it doesn't work like that. The self does not stand outside when we view the other. The self never gets a purely objective view because we are not detached. I often put it like this. We're not apart, A-P-A-R-T. Here, visual, you guys are falling asleep. Let's do it like this. apart, then you've got a separation. We're not apart, we're apart. Clever, isn't it? Do you like that? That woke you up a bit, didn't it? Descartes thought it was this one, but no, it's actually this one. We are a part of reality. Now, without getting again into the intricacies of this argument, and there's all sorts of epistemological volumes that have been written on this subject here, what I want you to see is that Descartes removed the self as the knower from its true place in reality. Now it's outside looking in. So Descartes's done two things so far. First of all, he's isolated self as the starting point for all knowledge. You start with a self, thereby you come to certainties. I exist, God exists, the world exists. And then secondly, he isolates a self by detaching it from the other. So now we're apart rather than apart. Now you put these two together and you see that the worldview of self begins right there with Descartes. Starts right there with the father of modernism. The seeds of narcissism were right there back with Descartes himself. Brian Appleyard, who wrote Understanding the Present, saw this when he wrote, Descartes embarked on a project that was to define the spirit of the coming ages precisely as Newton was to define its mechanics. Another writer, Robert Solomon, says, Descartes' epochal change in philosophy was very much a move towards subjectivity and the self. Indeed, there is no question but that Descartes was also the founder of the modern philosophical obsession with the self. It started with Descartes, who wanted objectivity, but the way he went about it actually lands you in total subjectivity because of what it does to the self. And the problem is this, that Descartes put the self at the very center of the knowledge quest. So now reality is anthropocentric, self at the center, and then he also isolated the self from the rest of reality, and so the self's now cut off from the real artificially. Now here we come to the problem. It's the problem of self-consciousness. For those of you who weren't here for my last lecture, I apologize. This was the heart of my lecture. And the heart of my lecture was the fact that self-consciousness is a problem. And it's a problem because the self can never know itself. That's actually part of how God intended it. The self cannot know itself. So that means that the more self-conscious you become in your focus, the more you create a problem for yourself. The more self-conscious you become, the more you see how you don't know yourself. Therefore, you try to know yourself more, and you become more self-conscious, and you try all the harder. And it's a tautology that goes round and round and round. That's the problem of self-consciousness. Now, the Cartesian method here puts a whole new degree of focus on the self. It makes the self autonomous in the world of knowledge, and even worse, it isolates the self from the rest of reality. And all this puts a new focus on the self. In fact, I would contend that never before in human history has the focus on the self been greater than it was with Descartes and that which came after. And that's because no one else ever tried what Descartes did. All other pagan cosmologies were not nearly so self-focused. And the Christian worldview before Descartes wasn't so self-focused either. So with Descartes comes this problem of self-consciousness because of what he did. Now it's important for us to see that this self-consciousness was not a huge problem for the modern from the start of the Cartesian project. In fact, the Cartesian project served to promote the utopian vision of human progress and happiness. And that was so much a part of 17th and 18th century thought. The self can do it. So positive. So the Cartesian project gave to the Western world a tremendous confidence in the ability of the human self. Descartes set the self free to conquer the world. So now the self is sufficient in knowledge and can discover the truth about the universe. And that's why there was so much confidence in the self's power back in the 17th and 18th centuries. The early modern felt very good about the self. And this is reflected actually in the paintings of that era. You could spend time even listening to their music, but looking at the paintings, a confidence in the human self. Now it was only later that the problem of self-consciousness arose in a negative fashion. Descartes makes us conscious of the self, but we have a lot to feel good about the self for. We can understand the whole of reality. But later on, the problem arises in a negative fashion. And this self-consciousness corresponded with a growing skepticism that later began to plague the modernist project. skepticism came back. Now, it's interesting. This skepticism was actually a ticking time bomb within the Cartesian project. Because remember, the seeds of skepticism were already implicit in what he did. Where did he start? He started from the place of doubt. I doubt absolutely everything. That means I think, therefore I am. The point is, the doubt came first. Descartes started with doubt. So it was doubt, not faith, that was the path to knowledge. Now that was another fatal flaw in the Cartesian project. Because in a sense, Descartes defined the fragility of modern knowledge. Because he started from the place of absolute doubt. And that's the opposite of Christianity. Biblical Christianity starts from the place of God as the ground of all reality. He is the ultimate reality, the most real being. That's where Christianity starts, biblical Christianity. Descartes started with absolute nothingness. Nothing exists. I'm thinking, so I am. The place of absolute nothingness is not a very strong place to start from. In fact, that's what you call a weak foundation. A weak foundation. And that's why it wasn't long before doubt began to surface again. So after a time, doubt began to eat up certainty like a cancer. That's what happened as modernism went on. Roger Lindon again says, Descartes infected the modern man by simply pointing out how limited were the available certainties beneath the corrosive gaze of honest skepticism. Now this is why by the end of the 18th century, the rationalism and empiricism that had done so much to build up the Enlightenment project succumbed to the pressures of skepticism. You see this in philosophy. From Hume and Kant onwards, there was a huge challenge to the whole notion of self-certainty. After Kant, there was an attack on the claim that the mind had the ability to comprehend reality, the thing in itself directly. There was an attack on that principle, that Cartesian principle. And skepticism came as a result. One of Descartes' contemporaries was a philosopher who's my hero. I've been reading him for the last year. You've heard me quote him often, Blaise Pascal. These guys were contemporaries. And the reason I love Pascal so much is that he saw what Descartes was doing in the moment and critiqued it. Where everyone else jumped in the bandwagon, Pascal was the only one who said, this is bad news. Only one who saw it. He's one of the great heroes for me, Pascal, because of what he wrote in Descartes' time. Pascal says, Descartes did everything except secure the position of God, and thereby the meaning of man. Descartes didn't even start with God. He came to God later. Our knowledge allows us to do so much, and yet it exposes us as small, accidental, and ignorant. Man alone is but a feeble foundation for the truth. Pascal saw it. But no one else did. Everyone else initially jumped on the Cartesian bandwagon. And it wasn't until later that the flaws in the Cartesian project were spotted. But by then it's too late. Now, the growing skepticism that grew out of late 18th century thought left the self in a very vulnerable position. Because where at the beginning of the Cartesian project there was all this confidence about the self as the true knower, now a growing skepticism begins to attack the modern self. The self cannot know reality in itself with the certainty that was earlier claimed. And this begins to raise questions about the self's value. So Descartes gives the self a new focus, this new level of self-consciousness. At first we feel good about that because we can discover the truth. Skepticism comes on and then we say, well, what can I know with certainty? And then we begin to question the self because we become self-conscious. So you see the process. Descartes isolates the self, makes us more self-conscious than ever before. At first we feel confident and good about the self. We can discover all the truth outside the self by our own rationalization. But then when skepticism strikes back, the self has no reason to value the self. The problem, however, was this. We're stuck with this heightened degree of self-consciousness. We're stuck with it. Because the self has been isolated from the other. So what do you do with the self now? Well, stuck with this increased level of self-consciousness, we have to ask, how do we value the self now? Now that it can no longer know the other with certainty, objective truth, how do we value the self? Well, the Romantic movement, the end of the 18th century, was an attempt to find a new mooring for the self. That, for me, is what it was about. And the Romantic movement, for me, is really a major retreat into the self. It's a withdrawal from the other. And in many ways, you can see the Romantic movement as a reaction against the rationalism which had led up the dead-end street. The fact that we thought we could discover the truth outside of ourselves through the mind. Now, for the Romantic, the self is still the determiner of the truth, but now it's set free to interpret life in its own way. The self no longer takes the other, the real, as its starting point. Now it can interpret life more freely in the way it wants. So life is to be understood now through what is being called the stream of inwardness, inward mysticism, intuition. So rather than looking outside for the truth, we're looking now more and more inward, going into the self. And that's why the catchwords of the Romantic movement is feeling, imagination, experience, yearning. That's what it's about. So you see what's happening. The focus is now much more on the subject to the exclusion of the object, the other. And narcissism is coming on with increasing power. This is the Cartesian chicken coming home to roost. You see, Descartes created a self which was isolated from the other and self-sufficient in knowledge. But now the self is no longer sure of itself as self-sufficient in knowledge, and that leaves a badly dented ego, no way of valuing the self. So now detached from the other, that's what Descartes did, alone in the cosmos, it begins to retreat inward. And now it's looking for ways of valuing the self along paths which are purely self-referential. Now, ever since the Romantic movement, which was predominant through all of last century, the Romantic movement, ever since this, we've never really escaped this inward preoccupation, this obsession with the self. Roger Lindon says that the postmodernist is in every way a child of the Romantics. He stands alone in nature, defying demands upon the self and searching for that which will satisfy. You see, now the modern self has given up the search for truth. That's what Descartes started with. We've given up that because it's impossible. You can't find truth. The skepticism of the fact that we could see the truth in and of itself with perfect objectivity, we've lost that. So now with no hope of discovering the truth, the modern self now simply looks for ways of satisfying the self. Because we're cut off from the real, that's all that's left. The preferences and desires of the self. So with no possibility of discovering the truth, there is no goal for the actions of the self save the fulfillment of its desires. There's nothing to direct the self except its preferences. And it's here, of course, that we enter into the world of narcissism to which we belong. This is the final end of the Cartesian self. And last time I looked at this intensity over profundity principle. This is exactly what I'm talking about here. Now, this self-referential world is not just reflected in the way we live out our lives as modern people. It's also reflected in the world of late 20th century philosophy. So hang with me just a little bit more. We're going to do a bit more philosophy. I wanted to show you where Descartes ended us up. And here again, in late 20th century philosophy, we see the end of the Cartesian project. And it's a very sobering world. Those who come to Le Brie who are studying modern philosophy come here often as very broken people. A very desperate world to move in. Now, in order to illustrate this, I want to briefly look at one facet of modern philosophy where the Cartesian world is unraveled, brought to its logical end. And this relates to the world of language, the world of language. So much of late 20th century philosophy has revolved around language. And we've witnessed in the latter half of this century a tremendous skepticism about language. And this is known as deconstructionism. That's the more popular term for it, deconstructionism. And the deconstructionist claims to be able to take language apart and show us that it's not doing the job we thought it was, building the skepticism about language. For instance, let me illustrate this in a few ways, just to show you where it's all ended up. For instance, we thought that words could be well defined. So, I've just used the word deconstructionism. Well, you say, what's deconstructionism? I've heard the word thrown around here once or twice at Le Brie, but what is it? Well, I know what I'll do. I'll go and look it up in the dictionary and I'll find out its meaning. But, the deconstructionist says, have you ever considered the fact that every word is defined by other words? And then these words then need to be defined by other words. And those words have to be defined by other words. And you go round and round and round in a circle of words. That's what you end up with. And it's like a maze. Reality is a maze where you just become lost in a world of words. And so the self becomes lost in a world of endless signifiers. We did a bit of semiotics last time. Signifiers are those which are the symbols, give meaning, significance to the signified, the real. But they're not the real. But now deconstruction says forget the real. We're just lost in the world of words, of signifiers. That means we've lost touch with the signified objective reality. And at the end of the day, many of them take it to the point where text is all that exists. That's all you have is text. So the real objective reality is lost. Then the deconstructionist goes on to challenge us at the point of interpretation. Because we think every text has a correct interpretation. So Gus is reading Moby Dick, and I mean, everybody can know exactly what Moby Dick's about. You just look at the text and use a proper hermeneutic to find out what the author is saying. But again, the deconstructionist reminds us that there's a huge problem here too. And that's because the problem is this, that the way we use words is shaped by our backgrounds and our experience. And because of this, there's never any precise meaning to language. It's a very self-referential thing. And that means you can never know with precision what the author intended. And you take authors like the biblical authors who wrote thousands of years ago, you'll never get into their worlds. It's too far away. So you can never know exactly what any author intended. You can't get into their mind. You can't uncover their meaning. So at the end of the day, the author's intention becomes completely irrelevant. You'll never get to it. This is also connected to the fact that words have to be defined by words, and you're just lost in text. So because the author's intention becomes irrelevant, all you're left with now is your interpretation. What does it mean to you? So reading becomes a purely self-referential thing. This is what many people do with the Bible today. So you can't find out what the Bible really says. It's just a self-referential interpretation. And everybody's interpretation is different, and one is as good as the other, because there's nothing actually fixed in the text. All interpretations are equally valid or meaningless. Everything at the end of the day is just interpretation. So the self determines the meaning of the book, or the self determines the meaning and the significance of a painting. It's purely self-referential. So what this means again is that the other becomes lost to the sign user. There's nothing fixed or determined in terms of the other. The self is free to interpret as he or she pleases. And I tell you what, people who study what's known as post-structuralism and come to Labrie, their whole relationship to reality can often be very scrambled if they haven't used their critical faculties. This really does play with the mind. Now, this is where the Cartesian Project has landed us, where modern philosophy is. The isolated self now interprets that which is outside of the self as he or she pleases. It's just all about interpretation. Moving on again, the deconstructionist challenges us at another point. Because we think language describes what is there. It describes the other. It describes the real. But the deconstructionist says that that's wrong. That language actually constructs meaning. Language imposes meaning. It shapes reality. It makes it. And it does so in a very arbitrary way. You take the words male and female. In these words, one sex is made central, male. The other is derivative, female. Okay? Two words. Now, the deconstruction would say that this does not describe something that is real. It prescribes it. It prescribes it. It conditions reality. It doesn't reflect reality. It conditions reality. It makes the world male-centered. That's what language has done. It's constructed reality. And the deconstructionist says that all language works like that. It doesn't describe some objective reality. It actually shapes what we see. And it does so in an arbitrary way. And at the end of the day, they say language is all about power. Men, physically stronger than women, so they made themselves central. And they did that through the use of language. It's all about power. All we're doing all the time is using language to manipulate and control other people. That's what it is. It's a power play. Now again, what we see here is the loss of the other, the loss of objective reality. Because now there's no more real for our language symbols to correspond with. The self now constructs reality through the use of language. And again, you see the Cartesian chicken roosting here. The self is at the center, but now we're no longer dealing with what's really there. We're actually constructing the real with language. And notice how we're actually back to the point where Descartes started, the place of absolute doubt. We're at the point where nothing exists. It's all a big language game. Constructed reality. It's radical skepticism. It's a place of absolute doubt. Let me finish this point on language by noting that modern philosophy has not just deconstructed language. In the end, it's actually also deconstructed the self. Because for the deconstructionist, even the self is now reduced to signifiers, words which have no meaning. And all we have left to define the self is meaningless symbols which we can arbitrarily choose and then discard. It's the only way we can define the self, by text. Text that has no meaning, really. So the whole of reality is lost in meaningless symbols, and the self, too, is lost in this world of meaningless symbols. And this means at the end that the self no longer really exists. It's just too part of the text. And it's interesting how post-structuralism actually wants to deny the self completely, to annihilate it. As a lot of postmodern art wants to do too. So this is the scrap heap where the Cartesian project has finally landed. It started with absolute doubt and skepticism about everything, and it's ended there again. And I think it's one of the main causal links behind the catastrophe of the modern self at the end of the 20th century. Now, if some of that lost you, don't panic. But I think this is an important place to go. We have to go back to Descartes. This is the root, I believe, so much of the root of the modern self in terms of ideas. Let me move on to my second heading now. This is much shorter and hopefully a little easier, and that's science. What about ideas in the realm of science? How have they created this worldview of self? I started by trying to show you how philosophy has led to the crisis of the modern self, but this same trend can be outlined with respect to the rise and development of modern science. Science, too, has played a huge part in creating a culture of narcissism. Now, like so many movements, it's very difficult to trace precisely the genesis and development of modern science. But I think many would date the rise of modern science to the time of Isaac Newton in the 17th century. And this moment corresponds with a movement known as the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was basically a movement which carried forward the Cartesian project. I think we often see it a little bit like postmodernism. We see it as something completely brand new and unrelated to what's gone before. And the Enlightenment is something completely brand new. It wasn't like that. It was... And the Enlightenment was basically a movement which carried forward the Cartesian project. I think we often see it a little bit like postmodernism. We see it as something completely brand new and unrelated to what's gone before. And the Enlightenment is something completely brand new. It wasn't like that. It was a growth out of modernism rooted in Descartes. And really, the Enlightenment was a way of dealing with the problem of God. Because although with Descartes, coming out of Descartes, human reason had been elevated above divine revelation, the idea of God still exerted a tremendous influence in the culture. And for the movers and shakers of that moment in history, the idea of God was a hindrance, a huge hindrance. And it's an idea that everybody believed. And it had a central place. Indeed, the church's central place in the world of ideas represented a major barrier to development in the minds of the movers and shakers. Because the church represented tradition, and this was all about enclosure to progress and discovery. So if you move the church and the idea of God from the center, then you could have real progress. So the Enlightenment was really a moment when God and the church were effectively removed from the center. And this then set free the modernists to unlock all the secrets of the universe. He was set free from the enclosure of the idea of God, centrality of the church traditions. They were removed from the center. Now the modernists could unlock all the secrets of the universe. Now again, what fueled the Enlightenment Project was tremendous optimism and confidence. We've lost that in our age by and large, but back then it was all about progress, progress, progress. They were so optimistic. In fact, if you were around in the 19th century, last century, at the very height of the scientific and technological revolution, and you had asked someone, what is truth? Like Pilate asked Jesus, the answer would have been simple. Science is truth. Science is truth. And we thought back then that human knowledge was nearing completion. We thought we've just about got the whole world in our hands. And then that bad guy Einstein came along and caused a lot of damage. And Heisenberg, even greater damage. But back then, we've almost got a unified theory that holds the whole world together. We thought then that human knowledge was nearing completion. We also thought that the power of the self, the Cartesian self, through the application of that knowledge was approaching that of the gods. Think of the English Victorian self. Take on the whole world. So again, although the Cartesian self was isolated from the other, there was plenty of reasons for optimism, plenty of reasons for feelings of self-worth. But what I want to highlight now is how the new scientific mindset actually undermined the place of the self in the universe. And I want to show you how this happened in two ways. Firstly, we need to see how modern science made a mother into a machine. Modern science made a mother into a machine, and this had a huge impact on the modern self. Now, as you develop this point, it'll be helpful to think of our universe in terms of scale. This is where I want us to start. Because the scale of our universe in terms of its magnitude is quite overwhelming. Not only are we not able today to count the individual stars in our universe, we've actually reached the point where we can't even count the galaxies. And each galaxy contains billions of stars. If you want to literally blow your mind, do a bit of cosmology. The magnitude, the scale is just too much to wonder at. And to get to our nearest galaxy, we'd have to travel at the speed of light for 2 million years to get to Andromeda. And there's galaxies beyond that which we can't even count. We can't even number. That's a big universe. Now, in the light of that universe, we can either be overwhelmed to the place of wonder, where you go, wow, that's amazing. Or you can be overwhelmed to the point where you withdraw from the other into the self. You're overwhelmed in one of two directions, to the point of wonder or to the point of being terrified and withdrawing from it all into the self. Now, the way we are overwhelmed in those two directions will all depend on how we view the universe. If the universe is just an impersonal machine which is closed, we will withdraw from it into the self. But on the other hand, if the world is personal and points to something beyond, we'll be brought to the place of wonder. Now, for the first time ever in human history, modern science reduced the universe to the impersonal. The world was reduced to something which is closed. It didn't point to something beyond itself. And this has had a significant impact on the self. That's my main point. Now, let me back up a moment, because it's important for us to see that the universe of the Middle Ages, the pre-scientific era, was still conceived of in terms which were vast. Somehow this fallacious way of thinking that the medieval view of the universe was of a small universe. People like Ptolemy had a huge view of the universe. It's absolutely vast. But the point is that vastness did not overpower the self and make it feel lost. And that was precisely because the universe was conceived of in terms which were personal. You see, the pre-scientific picture of the world was of something anthropomorphic. Anthropomorphic. Man, human shaped. It had personality to it. In fact, the earth was seen as a mother in pre-scientific terms. And please don't misunderstand. When we talk about Mother Earth, or someone says Mother Earth, we immediately jump on them and say they're New Age. Christians in the pre-scientific world also viewed the world as mother. They didn't worship mother, but they viewed it in a very personal sort of way, and they use that sort of language. You see, in the pre-modern worldview, the universe was supernatural. And this meant that the ordinary, things we see around us, trees, grass,
sky, all of this was infused with the sacred and the divine. And so for the pagan, this was the nature of the real because of the gods which were behind all of nature. That made it a personal supernatural universe. But for the medieval Christian, which marked most of pre-scientific Western Europe, the world was personal because of the supernatural presence of a personal God. God was in his universe, and that made it personal. So my point is that the supernatural dimension made the universe a personal one. Now, for the medieval person, the vastness of the universe was used to show forth the vastness of God. Huge universe means huge God, powerful God. And in their world, the universe was not closed. It was something which pointed beyond itself to the Creator. And this is what made its magnitude something which was manageable. They were overwhelmed to wonder. It was a personal universe. Why? Because the God who existed outside of it was himself personal. Personal God, personal universe. They didn't think it through philosophically. That's the impression they had of the world they lived in. Now here we are today in the same vast universe, except modern science, of course, has given us an even greater perspective of its magnitude. But the difference is this. The universe today no longer points beyond itself. It's a closed universe. It's one that is silent. And because the universe is closed, it no longer points beyond itself to someone who is personal. And of course, at the very same time, modern science, the Enlightenment, stripped the universe of the supernatural, which is such an irony to me, because the word Enlightenment almost seems to have the view of the supernatural in it. But back at the Enlightenment, the world was desacralized. The supernatural was taken out. And at that point, the world was reduced to a machine, from mother, the anthropomorphic, to machine. Now, I want you to see that in doing this, modern science reduced the universe to something out of all proportion to the human self. When the world was reduced to a machine, something impersonal, it then reduced the self to a calculator or to a ruler. And where the pre-scientific mind was a poet, it looked at its universe and constructed mythology, the scientific mind has become a calculator. A ruler, a measurer. And this is now the new relationship between the self and the universe. And my point is this, that when the universe became an impersonal machine, it actually had a significant impact on the modern self. Because the impersonal universe reflects back an impersonal self. If the universe is impersonal, where then do I find a basis for personality within myself? As Schaeffer often said, you can't get personal out of impersonal. And remember, while all this is happening, because of Descartes, we're much more self-conscious now. Who am I? And over time, I'm saying this, that the universe as an impersonal machine has impacted the modern self in a very negative way. The modern science has reduced the world outside the self to an impersonal machine, and the new scientific mind of the self is that of a calculator and a ruler, doing his measuring and computing. And all this reflects back to the self something which is impersonal. Now, there was amazing confidence at the beginning with all of this, because we can explore the world and conquer it. But after several hundred years of doing this, and after several hundred years, we've come to the point where we see that we don't have the world in our grip. We're further from the unified theory today scientifically than ever. So after several hundred years of doing this, the modern self can take it no more. We no longer like being calculators and rulers. There's a message about the self and all this which no longer gives us a basis for value and dignity. So because of this, we've withdrawn from the impersonal other. There's nothing out in that impersonal machine to give us a basis for valuing ourselves. So now we've withdrawn into the self in order to find a new self-representation system. Similar thing that happened in philosophy. This is what the movement from mother to machine has done to the modern self. It has also affected the modern self in this way. As a machine, the universe is lifeless, mindless, and purposeless. Machine, think about it. A machine has no purpose, no mind, no life of its own. And because it's a machine, it cannot answer questions about the self to do with meaning and significance. And here I say so much for progress. Has modern science really given the self a greater knowledge of nature? No. I think the opposite is true. Our knowledge of nature has actually shrunk because now it's empty and purposeless. And we may know it better as a machine today, but the scientific mindset has not increased our knowledge about the things that really count. Meaning, significance, where's history going to, where's it come from? And all of this for me is a minus, not a plus. That's not progress, that's regress. Now I say that because in the pre-modern world, the universe did provide a way of finding cosmic place and meaning. But no longer is this the case. And for me, this is actually illustrated in a change within our language when it comes to our universe. It's very interesting that the pre-modern looked at the cosmos and called it heaven. Now we look at the sky, we call it space. Fascinating. Happened in the modern era. The movement from heaven to space. We've gone from a fullness word to an emptiness word. That's not a plus, that's a minus. Fullness word to an emptiness word. And I think this fall from place to space has had a significant impact on the modern self. It has made the word alien and unfit for habitation. You see, place is where home is. You have your home in a place. To be in a space is to be homeless. That's where the police move you on. You're not supposed to be in this space. Move on. Place is where home is. Space is where you're an orphan. And I tell you what, to be homeless is to be in a very unstable condition. And I think because of modern science, the modern self no longer has a home in terms of his relationship to the other, to the universe. So we have become orphaned in our universe today. So here we are cut off from the other, consciousness, because this is the only thing we have, and no home, on into the self. And this is what science has done in this. My last science is its inability to define the self. Science's inability to define the self. Brian Appleyard in his book Understanding the Present reminds us how science has been incapable of helping us to get to grips with the self. And it's almost ironic that at the end of the day, for all the progress science has supposedly made, it doesn't explain what really matters to us. It's proved incapable of telling us who we are. In short, science tells us pretty well nothing about the self. Now, given our little lesson in semiotics last time, we know that's because the self is unknowable. I thought of another illustration. Do you know what? You've never seen yourself before. You've seen images of yourself, but you've never seen yourself before. Isn't that extraordinary? I see all of yourselves right now, and you've never seen yourself. Extraordinary. All you see it is an image. You've never seen the reality of it. Just another illustration how the self is unknowable. Now, coming back to my point, where science can offer an explanation at the level of the biological and the chemical with respect to the self, the human being, it doesn't help me to understand the essence of myself. What can science tell us about personality? Read Richard Dawkins at that level and see how he has nothing to say. What can it tell me in terms of what it means to be moral? What can it tell me in terms of what it means to love? It can say so little at those points. And it's interesting that though Sigmund Freud, tried to explain the self in a scientific manner, that was his endeavor. He wanted psychology to be a hard science. Later 20th century, it's a soft science. No one takes it that seriously as a hard science anymore. Freud's enterprise has failed. And the fact is, science hasn't succeeded in producing theories and predictions that are anything like as effective as those in the physical realm. And that's why, as I said last time, there are so many theories connected to human personality. Now, what is at stake here? Well, it's our ability to cross the inner frontier of self. Unbelievable. Science is everything we can know of the world, but it doesn't include ourselves. Now, as Christians, we know the reason why science has been unable to cross the frontier of the self. That's because we bear the image of God and can only be understood in terms of our likeness to Him. And that means that the basis for the knowledge of self is the knowledge of God. Calvin starts his institutes like this. We only know ourselves as we know God, because we reflect Him. Only at that point, in the knowledge of God, is the inner frontier of the self crossed. But modern science, of course, ignored that fact. And it actually emptied the universe of the very person in whom we can define and understand ourselves. It killed off God. And that is why it has failed to explain us. And it's because science has proved incapable of defining who we are that we have again retreated from the objective world into the self. We haven't liked the hard determinism of science, which defines us purely in terms of machinery, of genetics, and failed to explain the other bits of us that don't fit into that category. Just leave them alone. So again, you see the concept of this withdrawal from the real and the retreat into the self. And here's the pattern of narcissism reappearing again. When the world outside of me doesn't give me any way of valuing myself, no sense of worth, I retreat into myself. Become self-referential. And science, modern science, gives me no means of really valuing myself. So this means that the modern is being forced to retreat into the self, to build up our own. So with no basis for value and dignity from modern science, we've been forced to turn inwards and build up our own. We reflect back into ourselves. There's been no adequate reference point outside for the sense of self-worth, so we've been driven inward. Brian Appleyard puts it like this. In a world where scientific knowledge works to colonize the entire universe, the self becomes a safe refuge. In here, we are safe from invasion. We've found a home. Remember, we're alienated. We found a home in the self. An escape from the eternal wanderings offered by science. The refuge of the self is something we employ as a defense at every passing moment. The self, deprived of a cohesive religious meaning and lost in a complex and vast technological system, retreats into self-cultivation as one way of attaining an identity. There he's describing narcissism. He's describing the modern worldview of self. Well, there, you might not think it was brief, but it was brief in terms of what could be said, a brief analysis of the ideological roots of the modern self, what I call the worldview of self, both the ideas that undergird philosophy, starting with Descartes, modern philosophy, and the ideas that undergird modern science, especially with its turning a personal universe into a machine. Well, let's leave it there. We have little time for questions, clarification, arguments, dead cats, tomatoes.
Can I just ask you, how was this foundation that they've got set up for itself, how was that undermined and done away with as being reliable, and who did it? And
yeah. Well, how was, when you talk about Descartes' self, you mean the self is self-sufficient in knowledge, the idea that we could understand the world as it is through self-rationalization. How was that undermined?
No, that he provided the, you're saying how he provided the self, his own existence as the foundation for all knowledge. Mm. He moved from certainty of his own existence to knowledge, proof of God, and then from there you can move on to know that they're actually objects.
Yeah.
The knowledge of those objects.
Mm-hmm.
And so on.
Mm-hmm.
So how was that foundation that he established in the reality, in the certainty of his own existence? How was that? Because that was the foundation. Once that's gone, then.
Yeah. Well, it was done in a number of ways. Philosophically, one of the people who really hammered it, you had the British empiricists, and Hume started to attack rationalism as actually a foundation for truth, and then he began to move it more towards sense empiricism. That is, you have to experience it through your senses, that which is outside of yourself. You just can't stay there. So that was actually the beginning of attack on Descartes. Then you had Kant's critique of pure reason, which again rightly showed that the Cartesian self as sufficient in knowledge was completely wrong. And I mean, that's been continued into this century. I talked about unnatural dualism of Descartes with respect to subject and object, the idea that the self stands outside and has perfect objectivity. A number of people this century, one notable guy who actually has a background in science, Polanyi, back in the 50s and 60s, did a lot of writing, drawing on Kant to show that, no, all of our knowledge is personal knowledge. And he wrote a book called Personal Knowledge to show that we stand inside the system. And even as scientists, we're affected by our subjectivity. We're affected by our presuppositions. We bring a value system into the science lab. There's never been a purely objective scientific experiment. So more and more the century went, this century's gone on showing that this isolated self from the from the extended reality is not the way it actually is. We are, come back to this distinction, apart rather than apart, which immediately does damage to the Cartesian self.
So the self that Descartes was certain on is a self that had already contained a whole variety of values and so on that were product of.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. Uh-oh. I need my spell check. Okay. See the connection between the two? In a second, just the main point I want you guys to take away, and this is something I really did gain from my reading of Schaeffer, ideas have consequences. If you've lost a lot of the philosophy here, you just go away thinking, man, it is important what I think as an individual, and it's important what we think as a culture. That will have radical significance in what we are doing now and what people are going to do in the future. Because we build on a previous generation's ideas. Esther? That all relates back to my last lecture. And I'm sorry for those of you who weren't there, because these really are building on each other. But there I was highlighting what I called the problem of self-consciousness. And I actually illustrated then from what's known as semiotics or semiology, which is the way symbols function in a word, the way language functions. And how do I, as a sign user, make sense of the world around me? Well, I make sense of it through symbols, through words. But the one thing I can't signify is myself. And this is actually something which is demonstrated in this. I can't actually find a signifier for myself. The self is unsignifiable. And that's just a way of making the point that we never know ourselves through the self. The self on the self never comes up with certain knowledge. And I was quoting from a book called Lost in the Cosmos by an American writer called Walker Percy. And he has wonderful and humorous illustrations of this. The fact that when we see two nights ago, I had to watch a video in which I was there. And it was the same thing again. I couldn't recognize myself in that video. When you see a photograph of yourself, Walker Percy says, you know, you pretend not to be looking at it, but the one you're really looking at is yourself. You say, is that really me? Yeah. So, but that illustrates the problem of self-consciousness. The more self-conscious we become, the more problematic it is. We say, well, who am I? Now, at the very end of this series of lectures, I'm going to show the way out of that, because the self has to be able to live with the self. But as Jesus said, we don't live with the self by focusing on the self. We live with the self by denying the self and going beyond the self. And in that point, we find a secure place for the self. But we've come to a world which is just so far away from that and has such a hyper self-consciousness. Unlike any other moment in history, which has created what I call this narcissism, or this worldview of self where it's all become self-referential.
In the very beginning, you said that Descartes had two aims and objectives. One was just the skepticism and atheism.
Yeah.
We'll consider that's true. And we'll say Descartes made their own move, and I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Philosophically. What is an alternative? Without going directly, you just said scripture and quoting something and doing some science and stuff.
Yeah.
Which seems very, it's in the age of, it's in the model of revelation.
Yeah.
So, is there anyone in history that prior to Descartes possibly had figured that out? Who they? Or is there anyone in the modern period who might be an exception to self-consciousness and the scripture model?
And from what you're saying there, you're saying someone who doesn't directly go to revelation,
right.
Divine revelation.
You don't have
You see, I don't. My view is that, this is where my epistemology, that apart from divine revelation, you will always come back to skepticism. So you look at the Greeks, that you go back to Plato, Aristotle, and see where the dualisms out of that worldview quickly landed people in skepticism. And my simple answer to that is epistemologically, I don't think there is any alternative to skepticism apart from biblical revelation, that you can never get out of that. And the way I'd argue it more philosophically is in a phrase used at the table yesterday, which was central to certainly Anselm. Augustine used it too, but faith seeking understanding, or I believe in order to know. And I believe that any type of rationalization apart from revelation is a problem. Now, we can get into a detailed discussion here about the role of natural theology. I know you're doing some work on that in your studies and the place of that. My view is that there's a limited place for natural theology, and the reason Pascal has become one of my heroes is that I think he has a really healthy regard for that, but he also recognizes its limitations. The other thing too is Descartes, in a sense, is a bit of a calculator himself. He wanted to reduce the mind to something which is much more of a mathematical formula rather than the personal dimension of it. And for me, truth is personal. Jesus Christ is the truth. God is the truth. They are both personal. So the moment you make truth impersonal, I think you've got a huge problem. And the other thing I like about Pascal is that he doesn't leave truth just at the level of mind and intellect. He talks about epistemology of the mind, but he talks about an epistemology of the heart. We see God with our hearts. This is a question we could go and go and go and go with, but that's my brief response to that. I don't think there's any way out of skepticism apart from extra-biblical divine revelation. Let me use the same illustration again. Did you get the male and female one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the derivative of those two words is the male part. Okay, so that actually, if you looked at those two languages, you could say that, though I think it reflects Genesis 1, but let's take the Bible away for a moment. It gives the male, say, the central place.
But you just put the arc about the other way around as well. The female is the central word, the male is just a shortened version of it.
I don't think you can do that linguistically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that works linguistically. So what they're saying is those words. This is what males, in a sense, have constructed language there to give themselves a certain place in reality. It doesn't actually reflect what's there. It's a constructed meaning rather than reflecting what's really there. So what language is doing is it's imposing meaning rather than reflecting meaning,
the reality,
that's right. And because...
Can you give another example outside gender?
Let's try and think of something.
Also
Yeah.
All those adjectives have become something that we've invented and prescribed. That's not the reason.
It's a very different way of illustrating it, but I think you're onto something there. It's more of the sociological devaluation of language. You look at our tabloid newspapers, and every year the headlines become more and more extreme, and you think, well, what can they say after that? I mean, you can't go any more with that, and it's constructing something. But in terms of the male-female one, something in that world, if we think about some of the civil rights issues, the word gay, it used to mean this. Now, it means something completely different. It doesn't reflect what's there. It's actually evolved, and it's actually a way of imposing something rather than reflecting something. But they say we could use any sentence we're using right now, and the deconstruction would get behind it and say, no, that doesn't reflect what's there. It's just a power game. Sarah Grant, who was here last week, not that she's bought into it all, but her main point of study was looking at how power functions in our language. And there's a high degree of truth there. The deconstructionists, all of what they say, there's a degree of truth. Mm-hmm. That is, you need words to define words, and you have to define more words, and so you can, at the end, just get lost in text. Hermeneutics is a very, very complicated field. How do you actually get to the intended meaning? And can you ever? Well, I don't think you ever. I think you spiral in and you approximate it, but I don't think we'll ever get perfectly to the intended meaning of any text. But that doesn't mean that it can't communicate. Because you spiral in, you get the essence of the text. And then the fact that we're all using language constantly in a very manipulative fashion to gain our ends.
Any satisfaction at all in what they're trying to convey or get across, especially if they say they were a teacher and teaching a course.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, they recognize these are some of the most intelligent philosophers of the century, and they recognize the whole irony of the fact that they use language to talk about their philosophies. I mean, they have to write books. that's right. Yeah, well, that's often what it comes down to. And they have to use sentence structures. And even in language itself, there's so much order. I mean, they try to say it's all this so chaotic and random and not fixed. I have a huge problem with that.
It's self-defeating because this is a bit of serious
fascination. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like everything is meaningless.
Yeah.
Well, for them, it's not. In a school situation, for instance, it means that you supply the information to the children, and they have to attach their own meaning to what you said and give their own meaning to the words, mm-hmm. make their own choices, and make their own reality. That's the kind of thing it leads to.
Yeah.
And it's coming through in our education system.
Oh, yeah. It comes right down to the way we read the Bible as Christians.
Yeah.
So all these things do trickle down. I mean, the big guys, Derrida and Foucault and Rorty and others, they're extremely intelligent people. Sometimes I wonder how seriously they take themselves. You sense they're playing a little bit, having a bit of fun. But it does leave its impact. And again, the main point was the self-referentialism that's kind of there. And they're actually reflecting there how it is. So I think they're correct there.
Well, thinking, as you said, growing out of skepticism that's led to cynicism.
Yeah.
So let's have a go at this.
Yeah.
It seems to be nonsense, but something might come out of it. Well, you're throwing a bomb into the library in case another wonderful tome of something better than the Encyclopedia Britannica comes out of it. Let's have a go.
Yeah. The reason it's so dangerous, I this little section I did in my lecture on semiology, without language we can't make, there's no meaning in our worlds. There's no way of recreating the world in a meaningful way for ourselves. You attack language and you've done a devastating thing. But I think language at the end of the day is unassailable. And I don't have the quote exactly right. And I haven't found it when I've read Nietzsche myself, but Nietzsche is reported to have said, I've read this several times from others, that though he's a guy who pronounced the death of God movement, he himself never said that God was dead. And he said one of the reasons why he found it hard to deny the existence of God was grammar. that within the syntax of language, the way language functions, there's an order, and there's givens in that that you can't break. And that for him was evidence of the fact that some kind of God existed. And a very perceptive point. Nietzsche can teach us lots in areas like that. And I really feel, I think it's very dangerous what the post-structuralists have done. And I'm thankful, myself personally, that I think it's on the wane. I've got friends in Eastern Europe who are doing PhDs in this sort of thing. One of them coming this summer. And she's one who just said, you know, we got through with these guys 10 years ago. And we're supposed to be a second-class country. But hey, we move past these guys along. You take them seriously? She was kind of intrigued by that. Because you can't. Where can you go from there? You pull language apart and you're left with nothing. You can't talk. So, yeah. I hope it's a blip. But for people who are in the heart of language study and language philosophy, it's a pretty. Can you get a little feel for what I was saying? You can imagine it could destroy the mind, play games with you pretty badly in your head.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like sometimes I'm surrounded by it. Liberal courses that are taught at college. I'm not doing it, but
yep.
The students
yep.
are.
Yeah.
Helping people here.
That's right. There's lots of here, yeah. Very damaging. But I wanted to link it with Descartes to show, well, this is kind of where it's unraveled. It's just all self-referential. And he's actually got to the place of absolute nothingness. Where he started, we've ended. So I think something new has to come now. I really believe that. I'm not someone who actually believes terribly much in postmodernism. I think what we call postmodernism is the outworking of modernism, is the unraveling. It's hypermodernism. And the same is true at a sociological level. So I don't actually think postmodernism is something brand new, this quantum leap into another world. I think we jumped on that bandwagon a little bit quickly, but many of my closest friends would argue passionately with me on that one and say, fellows, you're wrong. But that's my particular view, and that's what I'm sort of trying to do here, to show that this is the extension of modernism. The new is yet to come. Why don't we break for tea, and then at 4:30 we'll start our study work schedule again. Mm-hmm.